Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Flory, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning. And we're here in the matter of State v. Rundles. Just a little housekeeping. I will reiterate the suggestion to remain in gallery view for another reason that Sue didn't mention to you. In case you prefer to see a full screen of the speaker view, you would lose the opportunity to see the clock in a larger non-thumbnail format. So that's it's important to be mindful of the timing limitation. And so keeping it in gallery view will help you in that regard. Now, for the record, I will indicate what everyone here is aware of, which is that we are not live in the courtroom. But we are participating in this oral argument, all of us in different rooms or locations. And this is so because of the fact that we are not holding live oral argument at the Judicial Center. So thank you, counsel, for your willingness to participate online. This brings with it maybe some technical issues at times. It may be that because of a weak connection or other technical glitches, it may become difficult for you to see or hear all of the participants. If anything like that occurs, and it seems you're having difficulty either seeing or hearing either any of the judges or opposing counsel, please just wave or indicate somehow, and we'll try to pause so that the technology can get caught up with the argument. Because we are keeping an audio recording of the proceedings and not a video recording, it is still important for you to state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use it for rebuttal. And unless there are any questions, counsel for appellant, you may proceed whenever you are ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Coley Grush and I represent the appellant Dominic Rundles on this matter. Mr. Rundles is respectfully asking the court to reverse his convictions in this case. As he was not afforded a right to a fair trial. Firstly, the first issue on the case is regarding the testimony of the lead detective in this case, Detective Mark Sundgren, where the detective improperly referenced my client's post-Miranda silence during trial. The second issue that my client raises is the improper closing of the state's prosecutor that also impacted his right to a fair trial. And lastly, even if these two issues standing alone don't rise to the level of warranting a new trial in this case, the cumulative effect of those errors certainly do. The overarching issue in this case is truly whether Mr. Rundles was afforded a right to a fair trial or whether he was unfairly prejudiced due to the errors that occurred during the trial. This is a case involving four counts of criminal sexual conduct in the second degree. Mr. Rundles was convicted by a jury of his peers on counts one and count two, and he was acquitted on counts three and counts four. Now, those four charges relate to allegations where a timeline is important for the court to understand, and I believe it's spelled out both in my brief and the state's brief. But that the counts three and four were older allegations, at least older in time, whereas counts one and two, the allegations and what he was convicted on stemmed from a report somewhat contemporaneous with the allegations happening or the day that evening or the day after. And that's important as we get into what the detective testified to, and I'll get into that later. There was no physical evidence in this case. The evidence by the state was witness testimony, and certainly prior consistent or inconsistent statements came into play. But the testimony of the witnesses is key here. And when we're talking about the issue of my client's silence, where his accusers had an opportunity to discuss and tell the jury what had occurred, that improper testimony maybe tip the scales, unlike it would in a case where there was overwhelming evidence of guilt, including physical evidence.
So the standard... Mr. Grostrand, if I can just interrupt for a minute here. You're not claiming that this was intentional misconduct by the prosecution.
I'm not claiming...
Or are you? I guess I should say it just as a question.
I am not claiming it was intentional on the part of the prosecution. I am claiming it was intentional on the part of the investigator. This is a case where the record's clear that when this investigator blurted out that my client declined to speak with them during his investigation, both myself and the prosecution heard it. I objected and moved for a mistrial right away. There was a record made where both myself and the state talked about the great lengths that we went through to avoid this from happening. We knew this was an issue. In fact, the state specifically told the court that this investigator was expressly told, do not mention that Mr. Rundle's declined to speak with you.
Now, does that, I'm just curious whether you believe, since this is not an ineffective assistance of counsel issue, I'm trying to get a sense of whether, I'm sorry, since it's not a prosecutorial misconduct issue on this particular part of your argument, does it matter whether counsel advised the detective one way or the other? Isn't the real issue whether this was a violation? And if so, whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
I would agree with that, but I think with the court's analysis as to whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, we need to look, we can't look at it in a vacuum. We need to look at all the surrounding circumstances. And I...
No, I understand that, but how would whether this was intentional or not on the part of the prosecutor matter to whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, whether the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, if we're talking about inadvertence and a minor component of the case, I think it matters when you're talking about that as its impact on the jury. This was an outburst by law enforcement when he was trying to explain away why he failed to even try to interview a potential eyewitness in this case. And it appeared to be out of frustration. And if it's intentional, then the court can infer that it was intended to prejudice my client.
I'm still not quite clear on whether the intent, let's assume the officer's intent was malicious. I'm trying to get a sense of whether, how as a matter of law, do you see this affecting our harmless beyond a reasonable doubt or surely unattributable standards?
When we talk about the other cases that not only do I cite, but the state cites, many of these comments were made in passing and certainly relevant to the question at hand. The nature of the disclosure or improper disclosure, and even in the district court here, the judge indicated that this was inadvertent, she didn't hear it, so it had some less of an impact. When we look to the goals behind Miranda and properly advising people of their right to remain silent, if we're looking at the possible bad actors from the executive branch here, trying to use that to their advantage, if we have cases where it doesn't matter what they testify to, even if it's improper and intentional, that any convictions are upheld, it seems to fly in the face of the purposes behind Miranda in this case and protecting defendants from being improperly prejudiced to that degree.
That's what I was asking you, basically, that it doesn't seem to me to weaken your case, given our standard of review, or change the standard of review, regardless of whether counsel for the state had urged the detective to testify in one way or the other. The question is, what was the impact on the jury?
the impact on the jury, if we look at, there was an instruction in this case. I know jurors are, and juries are presumed to follow the instructions in this case, but this is, it was a post-Miranda statement. I believe the state agrees that the Fifth Amendment applies in this situation, that it was in fact improper. So when we look to whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, we look to the circumstances of what the jury actually heard. And many of the other cases where there was some improper testimony like this, oftentimes the juries would hear that this was, the silence was either advised by counsel or compelled silence from the reading of Miranda. In this case, the jury didn't have the benefit of that. So when we look at the timing of the allegations and we look at Mr. Rundle's failure or refusal to speak to law enforcement close in time to the most recent allegations, when we have egregious allegations against him, a jury can infer that any innocent person would stand up and say something. However, if they saw it in the totality of the circumstances under where he was going to be arrested and he was advised of his right to remain silent and he exercised that right, had the jury known that, I think it might have taken some of the sting out of that. But I think that goes to the point of trying to explain why the jury could convict Mr. Rundle's on two counts and acquit on two counts when his accusers were the same. The witnesses on all four charges were the same. There was certainly, in this case, some text messages and communications between his mother, one of the accusers and his mother, but there was also testimony regarding the older allegations about prior disclosures to his mother. So when we look at someone who's being approached and being accused of something improper and they assert their silence, exercise their right to silence, in a case such as this, it's not a good look, and the jury can't help but think someone who's innocent in this situation would say something to profess their innocence. And when we look at that impact that it could have had on the jury, that it can't be said that it's harmless error. Every case that I could find wasn't quite like this. I didn't find another case with a split verdicts. I didn't find another case with testimony alone used to convict. In fact, the common theme among these evaluations by the appellate courts is that the evidence was just so overwhelming. Yes, it was error, but it didn't make a difference. The same cannot be said in this case.
Before you run out of time, you may want to turn to the other issue in appeal.
I will, thank you. The second issue is the closing argument of the state. I understand the state can make arguments and argue the evidence to the jury about credibility. The state in this case went a little bit further, saying things like this is a mother's worst nightmare, and more importantly, specifically attacking the defense. There are some cases that indicate that prosecutors can talk about the impact of a witness of going through the trial process and being subject to direct examination and cross-examination, but the state here went further than that by, on two separate occasions, specifically attacking the harshness of the defense cross-examination to paint a picture that the defense and Mr. Rundle's exercising his right to cross-examination was somehow a bully to these kids. These are very difficult cases that are full of emotion, emotionally charged. We have children witnesses, we have parents who are witnesses, and to take it to that level, to disparage the defense and the tactics, certainly prejudiced Mr. Rundle's and denied his right to a fair trial. Now, if we combine those two to my last point before I run out of time, even if those standing alone don't warrant a reversal in this case, when we look at the entire case, the cumulative effect of it, the fact that the state was able to attack the cross-examination and basically paint the picture of this bullying tactic. And we had this bifurcated closing argument, which is a little bit unusual, but the jury was able to think about the prosecution's appeal to their emotions over a period of about 4 hours, where the defense had no opportunity whatsoever to push back on the improper inflaming of their passions. And in the state's defense, when they came back from that break, they did make it very clear that the jury is not to use their emotions. But at that point, Your Honors, I believe the damage had been done. And when we combine it with Detective Sundgren's testimony, it warrants the reversal of these convictions and a new trial.
But Mr. Grushin, you didn't object to any of the closing argument, did you?
I did not.
So doesn't that change the analysis somewhat? The claim you're making is that somehow the error here was so obvious, the district court judge should have sua sponte interrupted the proceedings. That's a big leap, I think. And if it was so obviously prejudicial and improper, it seems to me an objection would have been noted.
Well, Your Honor, I can't explain that except at the end of a week trial, trying to counter arguments that are made during the state's closing, I didn't object to that. And certainly there's a different standard of review in that regard. And both the state and myself have noted that to overcome the failure to object.
Well, your time is expiring. I do have a question I'd like you to address, but I want to give you some time to think about it. So if it turns out you'd like to use some time for rebuttal, you'll be free to address it at that point. And that is this unusual circumstance, at least unusual to me, where the argument is that there are errors that cumulatively result in prejudice, when the standards that we apply to the prejudice prong differ so significantly. On the one issue that you claim as error, it is the state's burden to establish, if there's an error, state's burden to establish that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. On the other issue of claimed error, it is not only not the state's burden, but it's the burden on your client, and it's a pretty high burden under the plain error standard in challenging the closing arguments. And I don't know that I've had a case, I'm not aware of any case, where the argument is presented about the cumulative effect when we have such different prejudice analyses. How does that work? Assuming we agree with you that there was error, assuming we disagree with you that either one of the errors by itself is sufficient, how do we analyze this? I don't think the briefs really addressed it. How do we analyze this unusual variant in the prejudice prong? So give that some thought and you'll have a chance to respond to it if you choose to use some time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
So let's turn to counsel for respondent. Whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, counsel. My name is Heather Pipenhagen. I am an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I'm here today on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. And we are asking this court, this panel, to affirm appellant's conviction because appellant in this case had a fair trial. The first issue, I'll address the first issue first. The district court in this case properly exercised their discretion when they denied appellant's motion for a mistrial during this case based on the comment of Detective Sundgren. Now, I know the courts had a chance to review the record. This error by Detective Sundgren occurred on page, it's one line, on page 365 of the transcript. And it was on redirect when the prosecutor asked the detective why he didn't interview the appellant's brother. The first half of the sentence was the answer that clearly the prosecutor was looking for, and that was that the detective didn't think that he would be able to get an interview from him. But unfortunately, the detective went on to say, because the appellant had chosen not to speak to him.
Unfortunately, you say, indeed, after being advised apparently by counsel repeatedly not to do so.
Correct.
Why don't we infer from that, that at least from the officer's perspective, in order to sustain the conviction, it was important for the jury to get this little bit of insight that the officer was told he was constitutionally prohibited from referring to?
Well, I think that kind of goes, Justice Ross, to your question about what is the relationship between the inadvertence or intentionality of the detective's testimony versus the harmless error analysis. I don't think there is a connection between the two in this case.
No, perhaps not. But I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of, if we're trying to assess whether this was harmless, not just harmless, but harmless beyond any reasonable doubt, why don't we include in our assessment the fact that, I mean, usually we say, well, the district court was there, the district court saw what was going on, and so we give some deference to the district court. Why don't we give deference to the officer here? And the implicit deference being, well, the officer seemed to think that this bit of information that was unconstitutionally provided may have been necessary for the jury to convict. Why don't we consider that when we decide whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? In other words, it seems as if the officer thought this was significant and useful for the conviction.
Well, I think the problem here is the officer, you know, he's a witness. Witnesses are nervous. They're told at the beginning of a trial what can be talked about and what can't. But then when they're focusing on responding to a very specific question, which on redirect, it was a very specific question, why didn't you interview this other witness? His explanation was true and correct, and in his mind was the answer to that question. And what I'm saying is, unfortunately, he should have simply stopped with, I didn't think I would be able to get the interview, rather than the additional reason why he didn't think he could
get the interview. No, I think that's a perfectly plausible response, but certainly a much better response if we weren't aware, as we are, that in fact the officer had been, according to the prosecutor, repeatedly instructed, this is where you don't get to go. So when you suggest, well, it's just an inadvertent, he's just responding to the question. Well, he's responding to the question, but in the context of being told, when you respond to questions, you're not supposed to say anything about this, about the defendant's silence. This is troubling to me. And I'll tell you what else is troubling to me, and you can respond to it. I know that we've got this ocean of case law out there that says, well, you know, we're going to presume that juries believe, the juries follow the instruction of the district court. But it's true, we may have that presumption, but that presumption shouldn't always carry the day, should it?
No, and I think that's where you get the harmless error and the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that the state has to satisfy in this case.
Well, address that for me and just explain why it's not just why it's harmless error, but why it's so certainly harmless that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Sure. In this case, it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because this was essentially half of a sentence in a, I believe, over 600 page long transcript of a trial. It was never referenced again, certainly not ever brought up in the closing argument. The district court made a point in making a record that this part of his response was so benign that she actually didn't even pick up on it, and either did her law clerk, for what that's worth. That doesn't mean that the jury didn't. But the court made that comment on the record. And furthermore, the district court did craft, very well crafted, a curative instruction that incorporated the defendant's right not to testify with the defendant's right not to provide any statements at all. So the district court was able to put these two together, I think, in a way that did a great job of curing the error, and but not calling attention to that error specifically at the time, which the parties had agreed to, obviously strategically. That was the appellant's choice to do it that way. But I think we do presume that the juries follow these instructions and that the jury considered these two things equally, the appellant's choice not to testify and the appellant's choice, if they picked up on that part of the testimony, not to talk to the investigators. So in light of all of the evidence in the case, and sure, there was no physical evidence, but this is not unusual in a criminal sexual conduct case involving children. But what there was there was another witness specifically to the allegations against NL, was corroborated by CH's testimony at trial about what he saw, and also corroborated by CH's actions that night. He talked about how he actually at the last minute chose not to sleep over because he was disturbed by what was going on. And that is when he left and didn't sleep over. So that corroborates what NL testified to as far as the March of 2018 incident. And then furthermore, I think the best corroboration of NL's testimony about the touching of NL in this case was NL's frantic text to his mother at 2:47 a.m. asking his mother to come get him and if he could come home. I think that that is probably the most moving and solid corroboration that something had happened. Something happened over at the house with appellant. So do we have physical evidence? Do we have DNA? No, but we have a direct witness to this touching. And then we have other circumstantial evidence that very strongly corroborates NL's testimony in this case. So for all of those reasons, the very limited nature of that comment in the scope of this trial, the fact that it was never mentioned again, and all of the other evidence in this case, that is why this error, and I still submit that it was an inadvertent error, but that this, certainly inadvertent on the part of the prosecutor, that this inadvertent error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I just want to touch on it.
What if the defendant took the stand and testified, saying, absolutely, everything I'm accused of is false?
I guess, more specifically, what is the...
In the context of harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis.
I don't think it affects the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis. Related to that, an argument of appellant's that I wanted to address was his argument that the defendant's silence at trial somehow compounded the error by the detective, because the
jury... I want to go back to my question though. Assume that the defendant took the stand and said, all of the testimony of my conduct in regard to the sex assault allegation is completely false. It didn't happen. Would that bear or not bear on the harmless error analysis?
I don't think that it would bear on the harmless error analysis.
Well, in that case, we're just talking about a he said versus he said, or a he said versus they said. I mean, it's not like you had an avalanche of witnesses testifying to viewing this conduct. The jury might have believed him.
Correct. I mean, then they would have been able to analyze his credibility.
Right. And so therefore, I guess this is getting back to the heart of my concern here. If his silence could be interpreted by the jurors as Mr. Rostin is suggesting, which is, well, if I was innocent, I would jump to my feet and declare my innocence. The fact that if they've got this in the back of their mind now, is highlighted for them because of the testimony of the detective, that he did not object. He did not protest the allegations at the time. It seems to me that it directly bears on whether there's harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. If the absence of his protest is what's significant, then it seems to me that the fact that he didn't testify at trial, the fact that if he had testified at trial, would bear on the equation of harmlessness. It seems to me that therefore the idea of this being overwhelming evidence just because you had a couple of witnesses testify is in doubt, in my view. I'm questioning the overwhelming nature, the overwhelmingness argument that you're making.
And I understand that. And I mean, part of the appellant's decision not to testify at trial, however, was his strategic decision. He had the right to testify. He has the right not to testify. He made that decision after, you know, after consulting with his attorney, after the detective's testimony, and he made the strategic decision not to testify. And every defendant has the right to make that decision, but that is why we have the instruction that he asked for from the court, that the jury is not to consider that, that the jury is not to consider the fact that he didn't testify or give a statement to law enforcement. They combined that instruction. And again, we presume that juries follow that instruction. So it remains our position, and despite the fact that he didn't testify in this case, that it was harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt in light of the other testimony, particularly the immediate disclosure by NL of the abuse at 2:47 a.m. and having his mother come get him. I think that just was really strong evidence that something had just happened. This wasn't a young boy that fabricated this touching. And again, that it was witnessed by another witness in the case who was not a victim. So it is still our position that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And appellant talks about the fact, and I guess I'll touch on this because it relates to both issues, issue one and issue two, that somehow prejudice is demonstrated by the fact that these were split verdicts.
Well, can you, as you're addressing this issue, can you also touch, if you will, if you have any idea on it, this idea of the cumulative effect, part of the prejudice analysis, when you have two different prejudice standards being applied to the two different errors?
Sure, that's an interesting question, and I hadn't thought about it. And so what I was about to just get into just very briefly is that the split verdicts in this case don't, in our mind, demonstrate at all that the jury was struggling with this verdict. What the split verdicts show, if you really look at the charges, is they absolutely believe something happened in that most recent offense in March. They were not persuaded, probably because of some inconsistencies in the children's memories, about this 2016, the exact time frame of the 2016 touching, and that's why they did convict on those counts. It does not affect the jury's credibility determination on the more recent offenses. That's not what the split verdict means in this case. As far as the question about the cumulative effect of the errors, obviously our position is there was no cumulative effect of errors, that the original error was a harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt. When the investigator qualified his answer, again, unfortunately, as to why he believed this other witness wouldn't speak to him. And then as far as the prosecutorial misconduct, I didn't get a chance to touch on that, but it's our position there simply was none. So there is no error. There is no error. There's absolutely no plain error to combine with the other error to make a cumulative effect. So really it comes down to the first issue, whether or not it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and our position is that it was.
Assuming that we're not going to let you punt on my question so easily, let's just assume for the sake of argument that we think there were two errors. What's the state's position about how the prejudice prong, the cumulative prejudice argument plays out? What analysis do we follow? What's the standard when we have mixed errors And when I say mixed, I mean one of which calls for the state having the burden to prove harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. The other one, a plain error, simple plain error standard. How does that work?
I think the analysis just comes down to the effect on the verdict. And you have to engage in that analysis under either standard.
But how do we deal with the cumulative part of it? I mean, these arguments come up and we get them from time to time that, okay, there was error here, maybe not enough prejudice to reverse. Here's an error, maybe not enough prejudice to reverse. But in our Supreme Court, our court has on occasion said, okay, maybe you're right. There's not enough prejudice to reverse on any one of the individual errors, but you mix them up and we don't think this was a fair trial. How does it work? Have you ever seen it applied where you've got this various prejudice standards of review, different standards of review for the different errors?
I have not seen that. I don't know that I've had a case where I've argued that, and I definitely have not read any opinion where they address under the cumulative part of the argument, the different standards.
Yeah, but as you think it through, how would we, I mean, just logically, how would you propose that we would address it? Again, assuming that we found two errors.
Sure. I think it just really comes down to, do you think that it had such an impact on the verdict that the appellant didn't have a fair trial? And I don't know how else to analyze it with those two different standards.
Do we analyze it under a harm, just put them both under the higher standard with the state having the burden of proof?
I would not suggest that.
I wouldn't think you would.
Particularly when one of them is unobjected to plain error. I would not agree with that.
Of course not. But then of course the defendant would not agree to the lesser error standard being applied to the other. So,
correct.
Well, I gather I've taken you both a little bit by surprise in that question, but it's certainly one
bit.
That, but you agree that it's relevant, obviously, if it turns out there were two errors.
If it turns out there were two errors.
Sure.
Correct.
All right, Mr. Grossian, any rebuttal?
Your Honor, I want to touch on your discussion about my client taking the stand in his defense. It seems to me that if we allow law enforcement to testify, knowingly testifying about something they've been warned repeatedly not to testify to, we're almost in a situation where we are here, where when the jury doesn't know the surrounding circumstances of the silence, compelled testimony for the defendant to take the stand and say, I didn't speak at the time, and here's why I didn't speak, on the advice of counsel or because they read me my Miranda warning. It seems when we look at that issue, if we look to the purposes of silence being used in cases to impeach defendants when they do take the stand, like in the Borg case, that was the Mille Lacs County case where the letter was sent by law enforcement and was never responded to, or the case that cited Borg, the Johnson case, which I believe is a robbery at the outside the Pizza Luce in Minneapolis. Those were situations where it was pre-arrest or at least pre-Miranda silence. And that was used because the nature of silence, depending on the circumstances, can be used as evidence of guilt and harkens back to my point of, if you're being accused of something like this, like you mentioned, it's rational for somebody to say, I'm outraged you would even accuse me of something like that. So I think that the issue we have there is potentially getting to the area of where a defendant has to testify to explain himself, which just cannot
stand. Don't we get to that concern that you've just raised only if we disregard the presumption that jurors follow the instruction of the district court?
The courts have indicated that's a presumption, but we're not talking about a DWI case here. We're talking about a jury, many of which, certainly everyone was a child at one time. Maybe some of them were subjected to sexual assault. Many of them are parents. This is a different type of case where any type of prejudice like this can taint a jury just due to the nature of the allegations. And the court should take special notice of that, and courts have, that these types of cases, improper testimony like this needs to be scrutinized very carefully.
Have you noodled over that, the legal conundrum that I raised about the different errors and therefore the different error standards and how we deal with it in a cumulative error assessment?
Well, of course, it's our position. There's two errors here, and either one of them standing alone would be sufficient to grant our request. But I don't have a good answer, except I certainly wasn't able to find a clear legal standard. But if we look to the purpose of kind of discussion of the cumulative effect that courts have had, we look to the court's power and discretion in the interest of justice. And if we've satisfied the plain error, at least the initial burden of showing plain error in the closing, and we've shown some error, maybe close to being not harmless, the cumulative effect, if we look at the interest of justice, I don't have a good answer for you. And I believe you thoroughly stumped both of us in that regard, but it's...
That wasn't my goal.
I've got a quick question though, since in light of time. Is there anything in the record, in the transcript, that the jury would know that this was post-Miranda, this statement that Rundles wouldn't speak to him? Or is it just, I mean, as a matter of fact, we know it was, and the state and the defense agreed. So, but anything in terms of looking at the impact on the jury that they would know, it, as far as you recall?
No. In fact, immediately when this testimony was provided by the detective, we objected. There was a brief off the record conversation, and then we came back and we made a record where the state admitted that it was in fact post Miranda. I believe the officer indicated that it was in his intention to arrest him there when he arrived at Mr. Rundle's location. So the jury shouldn't have known the surrounding circumstances of Mr. Rundle's silence or why he chose to remain silent.
I don't know if this bears on the analysis at all. Obviously the jurors only saw that there was some discussion at the bench, and I gather there was an objection and then a request to approach the bench. I'm trying to, putting my mind back at the trial, I'm wondering if a juror would just simply, that circumstance, I'm guessing, would highlight to the jurors that something just happened, that something of some significance just happened. There was a question, the officer testified in some way, what did the officer say? And then a recalling of the jurors wondering what exactly is going on here. I don't know how that bears on the analysis, if at all.
Well, and that's the conundrum that attorneys may get into, where something like that happens and we're in a situation now where if I don't object to it, then I have to explain myself and there's a different legal standard upon review. But if I do object to it, you have to be careful and move forward with extreme caution as to how the jury reacts to it.
I suppose the best of both worlds then, as an option, and I don't think this would necessarily waive any issues, but to wait until the close of the officer's testimony and then ask the judge for a sidebar and point out that the reason for not objecting contemporaneous with the question and answer so as not to highlight it for the jury. I don't know that that waives your issue. But these are all hypotheticals. I don't know if they're relevant to our case.
Well, and you know, anybody can, you know, everyone tries to improve their performance in these cases. And
I'm not suggesting you did anything damaging to your client. I'm just, these are awkward situations. I know defense counsel always have the difficulty of deciding, do I object? Which is the reason why we have motions in limine, which is the reason why we counsel police officers before the trial so that you don't have to raise objections. Well, that's it. I think the matter is argued by both. Time has expired. Thank you both for your arguments. It's an interesting case. Well argued both in writing and in our oral exchange today. We appreciate your arguments. The matter is submitted and we will take it under advisement, issuing an opinion within our statutory period.